Resources Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. This is Thursday, February 10th, and we're beginning the public hearing on the Department of Environmental Quality. Mr. Siebert, do you want to set the stage for us?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, DEQ will be coming up in a minute. The Director, Stephanie Halleck, is here. They're going to begin with a brief program overview.
Director Halleck, would you come forward and begin your presentation?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And do I need to do anything special so that Senator Shields can hear other than speak up?
Senator Shields, can you hear the director?
Yes, I can hear her just fine.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Stephanie Halleck. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. And we're presenting to you, as I understand it, today and on Monday, Valentine's Day. Today I will start out with an overview of DEQ's programs, which I hope to conclude in an hour because I know you're interested in getting on to other matters as well. I would like to just briefly tell you who's here from my staff, as I may call on them during the overview. To my left is Jim Royce, my budget manager, who is also running the slideshow. Also Lori Onan, who I'm sure most of you know. She's our legislative assistant. Of course, Lisa Pearson is here from Department of Administrative Services, our budget analyst. Helen Lottridge, Management Services Division Administrator. Mary Abrams, who's the administrator of our laboratory. Andy Ginsberg, who is in charge of our air quality program. Holly Schroeder, who's in charge of our water quality program.
Is that Holly or Polly?
Holly.
Holly. Holly with an H. Okay, thank you.
And Al Kippett, who is in charge of our land quality program. So they told me at the beginning of this presentation that my performance measure today is to not need their assistance. So we'll see how I do.
Well, Madam Director, it's great to see that you take this seriously.
Absolutely. Okay, I'm going to start by telling you just a bit about what we do and how we assess our effectiveness. As you may know, we have been an agency since 1969. Our mission is to be a leader in restoring, maintaining, and enhancing the quality of Oregon's air, water, and land. And our goal is to provide a clean and healthy environment which will pay off for Oregon's economy and quality of life now and for future generations. I have been the director since November of 2000. When I became the director, I felt that one of the important things that needed to happen at DEQ is we needed some focus. And so I worked with stakeholders and with my folks to develop four strategic priorities in 2002. These are to deliver excellence in performance and product, everything that we do, to protect Oregon's water, to protect human health and the environment from toxics, and to involve Oregonians in solving environmental problems, knowing that we, in fact, cannot do it all. And there is a copy of our strategic directions in Appendix Roman Numeral 1-1 in your booklet, in your notebook. And we also have 14 key actions that we track at the executive level that inform our progress on achieving these strategic priorities, and I'll discuss those when we talk about performance measures. Oregon, our environment here in Oregon is, in fact, cleaner and safer because of what we have been doing since 1969. We are currently meeting all national ambient air quality standards throughout the state. We have taken care of 91 old, unlined municipal solid waste landfills that have been closed and therefore reducing the potential for leaks and contamination. More than 19,000 leaks from underground storage tanks have been cleaned up or are in the process of being cleaned up. 568 sites contaminated with other hazardous substances have been cleaned up or are in the process of being cleaned up. In 2002 and 2003, as you will see when we get to the discussion of performance measures, 141 pounds of mercury were removed from the environment through our efforts. Every year, about 280,000 pounds of household hazardous waste is collected, which has accumulated to a total of 3.6 million pounds over the 12 years that that waste has been being collected. As of February 2nd, more than 5,300 rockets containing sarin nerve gas and more than 56,000 pounds of that nerve gas have been destroyed at the Umatilla Chemical Weapons Disposal Facility. In water quality, 48% of Oregon streams are rated good or excellent in quality, which is up from 27% in 1990. In 2003, 32% of monitored streams showed improving water quality trends, up from 8% in 1990. And the percentage of streams showing declining water quality trends dropped from 20% in 1990 to 6% in 2003. And finally, the last fact I want to highlight for you is that our recycling rate in Oregon was 47% in 2003, which is ahead of the state target for 2005, which is 45%. And when I talk about the specific programs, we can get into that in more detail if you like. Talking about who we are, the state has been a leader in environmental protection for a long time. DEQ actually began as the state sanitary authority, which was formed by a citizens' initiative in 1938. The state sanitary authority became DEQ in 1969, and around that time, in 1970, Earth Day under President Nixon, was when Congress started passing a number of federal environmental laws that we now carry out for the U.S. EPA here in Oregon. We are governed by a volunteer commission, the Environmental Quality Commission, which is five members appointed by the governor. It is not statutorily required to be geographically diverse, but we try and make it geographically diverse, and it currently is. We cannot make any rules without the Environmental Quality Commission. I do not have unilateral rulemaking authority. We must go through appropriate public process for all rule adoptions, and they must take that action. They also issue orders and judge appeals of fines or other department actions over which they have authority. And they also appoint the director and assess my performance. Currently, DEQ has positions to employ approximately 810 scientists, engineers, environmental specialists, technicians, administrators, and support staff. In the early 90s, we moved most of our staff into field offices to be closer to the people that we serve. Today, about 250 of our staff work in our headquarters, and the rest are spread out in offices throughout the state and in our laboratory and in seven vehicle inspection stations. There's a map on page Roman numeral dash 4, no, excuse me, on page 1-4, I think that's correct, in our binder that shows the field offices. That's not the right page, tell me, and I'll have somebody tell me what the question
is. Stephanie, where are you exactly in the binder?
This would be the agency overview.
Agency overview.
Yes. Section 1, page 1-4.
Okay.
And that shows where our offices are. And we most recently moved some more people out of downtown Portland into a field office in Gresham, where we're co-located with the Department of Revenue.
And why did you do that?
We did that for two reasons. One is because, and there's a fiscal reason, which is we want to get out of as much high-dollar real estate in downtown Portland as possible. As you
may appreciate that.
Thank you. Our headquarters is actually in Portland. It's not in Salem. And so we have continually been striving to move more folks out in the field. And secondly, it's because in our Northwest region, which Gresham is part of, we had not opened as many field offices as we had throughout the rest of the state. We have a couple on the coast, but we are now moving people into what we call East Metro and Far West Metro. That will be our next spot to try and move more folks out of downtown Portland.
And again, in terms of history, Stephanie, the reason that you're in Portland is because of not just the largest customer base, frankly, in terms of industrial uses, but also because you work very closely with the EPA. They're headquartered in Portland also.
That's correct, is it, Mr. Chair?
Sort of.
Okay. Representative Krupp?
Just call me Mr. Chair, I guess.
Okay.
I've got the gavel, so I guess so.
Yes, there is an EPA office. They actually have an office in the same building in Portland in which we are located. And you are also correct that historically, way back when DEQ was established, at that time, most of the sources that were regulated were, in fact, in the metropolitan area.
That of course, has changed to some degree, and that's precipitated your desire to move some of your people outwards.
That's correct.
Representative Krieger.
I'll back up just a minute, because you mentioned something about cleaning up a certain number of sites, and one of them was it open or online, referring to dumps?
That's correct, Representative Krieger.
How do you do that?
I talked about, and probably because I was speaking more quickly than I should, there were actually two separate items. We have cleanups of actual underground tank, leaking tank sites, and we have cleanups that you hear referred to as Superfund of old industrial sites that are contaminated with hazardous substances that actually get cleaned up for reuse, one hopes. The landfills themselves under Subtitle D, Federal Subtitle D of the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, put in requirements for any landfill that was going to continue to be in operation. These are municipal solid waste landfills that they had to meet certain technical specifications for liners and monitoring for leachate and all that sort of thing. If they didn't, then they needed to be closed and could no longer take waste. And there is a closure process, but they're actually not cleaned up. I mean, the trash is not dug out of them. They go through closure and protection from leaking, and then they are monitored if there's a reason to monitor them.
Allison, there's one up at Seaside, not the one that's up on the Crown Road, but there was one right behind, walked towards the airport when I was about 5 or 6 years old, and they dumped in there for years, and then it grew up in alders. I don't think it was ever treated at all. I just wondered.
Representative Krieger, I'd be glad to check on that specific site. I suspect that like these other small sites, it was in fact closed, and it may or may not be monitored. And I believe, as you probably know, there is, for waste down in your part of the state, there is an incinerator that takes garbage, one of two that we have in the state, one in Marion County and one down there.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So next slide. You're already there. I will talk now for a few minutes about how we do our work. We have three major programs, and I introduced to you my administrators. We have an air quality program, a water quality program, and a land quality program. We also have a lab, as I mentioned, and we have our support services provided in management services, and I'll be talking about those later. We use a variety of tools to accomplish our work. As I mentioned earlier, we try to deliver our programs locally throughout the state. We do carry out the federal laws, environmental laws in Oregon, on behalf of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. That includes the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act that governs disposal of waste, and we are in the process of getting delegation of the Federal Underground Storage Tank Program. We also carry out environmental laws that you all have passed. Some of those historically have been the Opportunity to Recycle Act, the Toxics Use Reduction Act, and the Groundwater Protection Act. The tools we use, of course, we issue and enforce permits, and that includes doing compliance inspections and sometimes assessing civil penalties. But we also provide grants and loans, the largest of which I'm sure you're familiar with is the State Revolving Loan Fund for upgrades of wastewater treatment plants, sewage treatment plants. But we also have loans in solid waste and other programs as well. We do have some technical assistance that we still provide, although, as I'll be discussing with you later in terms of our general fund, neither the federal funds nor the fees that are paid by the regulated community support technical assistant type activities, and it's really the general fund in our budget that does that. And finally, we do have probably the major incentive program that we have is the Pollution Control Tax Credit Program, and I will also talk more about those later. We also are continually striving for efficiencies and to streamline our processes and to provide excellent customer service. and I have a couple of examples to share with you. I've been on a couple of the regulatory streamlining advisory committees during the interim, and I'm sure you'll be discussing some proposals that have come out of those committees. But in addition to that, one program that we're currently doing with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission and the Office of Regulatory Streamlining is to consolidate the fees. We assess fees and OLCC assesses fees to convenience stores that have underground tanks that pump gasoline and also sell liquor. And so we are conducting a pilot to be more efficient in how we work with those businesses. And we've had 55 businesses that are interested in participating in that. We also did a complete revamping of our rules in our septic tank program, and one of the key changes we made there was to make it easier to put in non-traditional, more innovative alternative septic systems, to not make the permitting requirements as rigorous or make it as expensive to do that, so that we can really take advantage of some of the new technologies that are out there. I would also mention that, and I'll be talking about customer service later on, in our septic program, we have had a 77% improvement in from 61% in the customers we serve in their perception of whether we are exceeding or meeting expectations, and I'll get into that in a bit when we're talking more about customer service. But we did a full court press on customer service in that program, and it's really paid off. Also, as you probably know, in our vehicle inspection program, we are already linked with the Department of Motor Vehicles to help facilitate getting registration and getting your car tested at the same time. Electronically, we are linked. We are now physically with one of our stations, the Sherwood station, going to try and physically, we have to move that station, and we're going to try and actually co-locate with the Department of Motor Vehicles for that area so that people can really get better service together. And then finally, we have recently in our water program developed a service quality pledge to our permit holders where we pledge responsiveness, timeliness, consistency, and clear explanations of requirements, and I will talk more about that later as well. So that's kind of the setting the stage for the specific program overview, and if you don't have any questions right now, I would move into each program and talk about each one of those briefly.
Members, questions?
I may have.
Senator, please.
Thank you, Stephanie, for telling me all the good work you do in my part of the country. I used to think I was going to get a lot of telephone calls about the DEQ, but I get very few. And Joni Hammond, who's the regional director, I think does a really a good job. That's that decentralized approach, and I think that's makes my life a lot easier, so I appreciate that.
Thank you.
It seems to me that your agency is undergoing a change. It has to change. It has to be have a far more sophisticated approach because it seems to me in the old days you were more of a bludgeoning hammer. You were trying to do these environments. But now you have to balance the economy with all these sort of things. We're in a situation where if we're not trying to strive to get jobs or create more jobs, then we can't fund our schools. We can't fund some of the things that we need to fund. And so I'd just like some comments from your viewpoint about this balance. I mean, how do you approach that? Are you making some changes in your agency?
Senator Nelson, I absolutely agree with you, and yes, we are. And what I would specifically call out for you are two things. In our strategic priorities, the little booklet that's in your binder there, the fourth strategic priority is to involve Oregonians in solving environmental problems, as I mentioned. And there is a key action in there, one of our executive measures, which used to say something to the effect, help communities solve our environmental problems. And that was a measure we had in there for what used to be called the Community Solutions Team and is now called the Economic Revitalization Team. And as you know, we are part of that team. We have actually changed the wording of that key performance measure for us to help communities solve environmental and economic problems. So we are recognizing at the executive level that they are linked and that the future of our economy is directly tied to the future of our environment. And you're completely correct in your assessment of that. And so we look all the time, and that's why I made the comment that I made earlier about my concern about the general fund in our budget, which is not large. We are 11% general fund, 66% fee, as you know. But that general fund, traditionally, a lot of it in our budget has been targeted at those efforts, including economic revitalization teams that are specific to supporting economic development. And we can talk more about that when we talk about the budget priorities.
Just follow up along those lines. I mean, our charge here has been basically saying, you're going to have to find some cost-cutting measures here. I mean, we're going to have to potentially get into your budget and do away with some of those things. You know, we can argue, I guess, both sides of that. But it seems to me one of the other issues that you have is the culture of the agency. I mean, I feel that there's been a shift, but I'm not so sure the agency is, the folks out there actually doing the job are shifting yet. Do you have any sense of that?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Nelson, I do think there's been a shift. I think, as I mentioned earlier, we're a little over 4 years into my having been the director and, quite frankly, having put an emphasis on that shift. And as you probably know, I myself ran a region for 6 years. I was in charge of DEQ's operations in Eastern Oregon. And as a result of that experience, I'm somebody who grew up in Portland, and having had that experience made a huge difference for me personally in how I perceive what we need to do our job. So I do think there's been a shift. I think that the issue is there's two things. First of all, you have to put in place processes and activities that continue to encourage culture change, whether it's ongoing customer service training, whatever it may be, involvement in the economic revitalization teams. But you have to also be continually vigilant. You can put in process and you can put in activities, but you always have to have in your mind, what is the customer going to want? And I'll give you a really good example that affects all of us in this room right now, because I talked to Paul Siebert ahead of time. As we, being good bureaucrats, put together our little spreadsheets for you in a way that made sense to us and doesn't make sense to you. And when it was pointed out to me that it didn't make sense, it was pretty obvious why it didn't make sense. So that's what I mean. You have to always be thinking, how is the action that you're going to take going to affect the person against whom you're taking the action? And you have to think that through. And it's just a challenge. You just have to do it all the time. And I don't know if I have a better answer than that.
One more follow-up on this pollution tax control, where there's a kind of a movement going through the building now is to look at these pollution or these tax credits that we're giving, saying that they are not to the benefit. And what are your performance measures? Do you have something that goes along with this pollution tax credit basically accomplishes what we're trying to accomplish? Is it really worthwhile doing?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, we do have a performance measure that addresses the pollution control tax credit program. The measure itself only addresses how efficiently we are delivering the program. We do not have an explicit measure that says if that program didn't exist in Oregon, would we still be getting pollution results? We can give you, and will give you when I get to that discussion, some examples. There are, for example, wood chippers. There are tax credits for wood chippers, and we have some data about how much pollution that takes out of the air for that. But overall, what's very interesting about that program is when it first came in years and years ago, it was before there was a lot of environmental regulation, and so it was indeed an incentive. Now, those tax credits, really a lot of them get to be given for regulatory requirements that folks would have to do anyway. So that is a huge debate that is far larger than just our agency, as I'm sure you know.
And Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Referring to the first statement or question that Senator Nelson made, I would feel it was safe to say I was not exactly a fan of DEQ the first time you came through the door. And over 4 years, she's fairly well won me over. And one of the things I asked her to do by the first term I was here with her, very short time, was to have the mindset change, the culture within the agency, and be problem solvers and solution finders. And every time I saw her, I would remind her of that. I think she was trying to move in that way and try to get the agency and the people that are below her had been there in place for numerous years doing things a certain way. You don't change that. You know, you don't turn that big ship instantaneously, but I think there's been an honest effort to get there. This is the only agency that every time there's a correction order or an order in my district, I get a copy of it with a little note explaining what, call me if you've got a problem.
Yeah.
That stops 90% of my problems. So I think they have probably made bigger strides in that direction that you're talking about than the other agency out there that I know of.
And I would add, Representative Krieger's comments, that I also do appreciate, as I think all of us do, those notes from you directly about issues that are ongoing in our districts. Some of them are issues that may not be on our radar screen either, and it's nice for us to know that you're interacting with our constituents. And sometimes they do call us, and of course we call you.
And once in a while, my people do something wrong.
Once in a while.
Once in a while.
Okay, all right.
Unintentionally, of course.
Unintentionally, all right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Please continue.
I just make one other comment about culture change. Obviously, a big part of that is legacy. And I can assure you, the people sitting behind me in this room were all put in their position by me over the past 4 years. And they understand absolutely what my expectations are about solving problems, not just running programs. And they are the leaders of all the programs at DEQ, and that's what you really have to do, is get that instilled through your organization. So I would move on to the air quality program with that. The purpose of this program, of course, is to provide healthy and clean air for all Oregonians. Air pollution comes from two types of sources: industries or so-called point sources. This picture is a DEQ inspector with an employee of a Pilot Rock lumber mill, an example of one of the kinds of facilities that we regulate. Most air pollution, however, in Oregon comes from mobile or area sources such as automobiles and trucks, wood stoves, outdoor burning, marine engines, off-road vehicles, the activities that we conduct every day. This picture, of course, shows our DEQ vehicle inspector testing one of the autos that we have in our testing programs in Portland and in the Medford area. In general, we control air pollution by issuing and enforcing the permits for about 1,200 facilities. We, in this program as well, we provide incentives. And then for the area and mobile source, we work with communities to implement pollution reduction measures at the local level. This next slide shows that the clean air work has been successful. In 1980, only 30% of Oregonians lived in areas where the outside air met national standards. Today, 100% of Oregonians live in areas that meet these standards. This percent is actually a benchmark, and we'll be talking about that a little bit later on. The solid line on the graph shows the number of exceedances of federal air standards from 1977 through 2003 compared to the population of the state during the same period, which is shown by the red dotted line. And to achieve these results, we did a combination of things over the years. Basically, we developed clean air plans for the whole state where there are air quality problems. And then we work with communities and businesses to select specific activities to reduce the pollution. And an example of that, in the southern part of the state, the Medford area, they had a particulate matter problem, and they had we worked with them on a huge wood stove buyout program to replace wood stoves with cleaner burning stoves. Because we're growing, particularly in Portland and in southern Oregon, this graph does not mean that the problems are solved forever. Just like with culture change, to maintain these kinds of improvements, we have to be continually vigilant to be sure we stay within the federal clean air standards. We also have a future challenge with air toxics. Air toxics are not shown on this graph. They are not a pollutant that EPA had been tracking and regulating in the same way as the other pollutants. And so we have been working with our stakeholders to develop a program for Oregon on how we may address air toxics in the future. Let me stop there on air, and I'll move on to water unless you have questions about the air quality program.
I did notice, Stephanie, that in reading through the narrative about the vehicle inspection program.
Yes.
And it seems that you've been actually reducing your staff in that area. Could you just briefly explain why?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. We actually did something very innovative. Andy Ginsberg, the air administrator, developed a 10-year plan for phasing down the fiscal needs of this program in combined with the greater efficiency that was being developed in cars at the same time. So that this was a deliberate plan when we were setting fees for this program. We knew that with the new kinds of testing methodologies coming on board and the cleaner cars, that actually the need for doing this kind of testing would decline over time. And so the staff, as we've put in new kinds of systems that are more efficient for testing the cars, and as the cars have gotten more efficient, we've been actually able to reduce the number of staff we need. And when you review our budget this time, you'll see that there is a further reduction in the staff needed for this program.
Very good. Yes, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This air pollution thing has always baffled me, I guess. I mean, the biggest air pollution we see a lot of times in the summertime is the forest fires that come over from Central Oregon, which you can't do anything about. The largest polluter now, as I understand, in the Northwest is Mount St. Helens. And so how? I mean, and then I look at our particular area where sometimes, as you probably know, the wind blows 30 and 40 miles an hour. So we clean out the air shed. And so I'm thinking, how do you measure pollution? You don't have to answer that. Is there some way that you can kind of, is there any sort of material or stuff that I could read that could kind of straighten me out on this? Because I just think air pollution, it changes over very, very quickly.
Senator Nelson, I can guarantee there is something you can read, and we will get
I'm
it.
I'm sure there is.
As if you need anything else.
Oh, I don't have near enough. Yeah.
But I'll try and give you a brief answer. One of the things that's important to remember is there are real differences in the types of air pollutants and where they're coming from. For example, in rural Oregon, you're absolutely correct. The air pollution that you'll see primarily is what we call particulate matter. And it comes from blowing dust, it comes from burning, from forest fires, whatever. And that is the air problem, for example, that they had, and we have to always be watching for in southern Oregon because of the topography and geography, that air can get held in the valleys down there, unlike Pendleton, where the wind tends to blow a bit, and it blows right out of there. So that's one kind of air pollution. Then you have the carbon monoxide and ozone and the vehicle-generated pollution. And by far, the most air pollution that we have to worry about in Oregon is from automobiles and trucks and small engines and things like that. And so there, monitoring is the short answer to the question. The way we tell where the problems are is we monitor. I'll give you an example of that. No vehicle inspection is required in Bend. People always ask about Bend because it's growing so fast. We maintain and have for years an air quality monitor at the corner of 3rd and Greenwood, if you know where that is, which is right in the middle of Bend. And every now and then, you'll get an exceedance. So it kind of varies on the weather. It kind of varies on the geography. And it varies on the kind of pollutant that you're monitoring for. But air monitoring is very, very important to keep track of that.
And I would just say, Senator, you know, Mount St. Helens is the number one polluter now in the Northwest. It's probably not going to be likely that we can find God for exceeding the limits. Strike that, would you please?
How about a building a big plug? We could just put it
in the Mr. Chair, I just would like to add one thing to Senator Nelson. And I was the last spring I was in China, and if, I don't know if anybody here has been to China, but they have huge air quality problems. And I don't smoke, but I feel like I'd smoked a pack of cigarettes every day because I could have such problems breathing. But one of the things when I came back is the concern about migration of pollutants from China into the Pacific Northwest. And I found out there's, it's called the Transboundary Project. It's a cooperation between Canadian and U.S. scientists. And so there's regional air quality monitoring going on, but we're finding a number of higher levels of certain heavy metals, especially, that are contaminating our airshed in the Northwest, and they're finding it's coming over from China. So there's certain things that are, you know, I don't want to say just out of our control, but things that, you know, it's not like it just goes away. It goes somewhere, and we're seeing now the impacts of the fact that China doesn't have very many controls on their air quality programs at all, and that's something that we need to be monitoring and working with the USGS and other organizations that are doing that type of monitoring.
That's absolutely correct, Representative Dingfelder. And in this country, an example of the real problems being addressed of that sort is in the north, in the Midwest, in the Northeast United States. They have transborder issues with Canada on air emissions both ways, and also in the Midwest, there are a lot of coal-fired generating plants, and so there are huge battles when I go to these national meetings between folks from the Midwest and the Northeast about who is responsible for this air pollution. So that's a very good point.
Well, you. Representative Dingfelder, you have piqued my interest, so now I'm going to ask a question.
I don't know the answer.
Do you do monitoring on the coast, and are you finding the winds that blow in from the ocean are already contaminated with this kind of material? This is the first time I've heard that.
Representative Krupp, I would ask my lab person, Mary Abrams, to answer a specific monitoring question. If she can today. If not, we'll get back to you.
You know what, Mary, in the interest of time, why don't you just write me up a little something and you provide it to the committee tomorrow, I'll be fine. It's not a pertinent question to what we want to accomplish today, but it is one that has interested me greatly.
There is, Mr. Chairman, if somebody can find the page, there is a map of our air monitoring network, I think, in the program overview that we gave you.
But you really
and Mr.
can't
Chair,
read it that way.
There's a great special, and I might have even taped it on this project. I think it was on OPB, and I might even still have the tape if not I can track it down, because it was an hour or two-hour special that talks specifically about the monitoring, the transboundary project, and the monitoring they were doing. Because I wasn't aware of it until I saw this. So I came back from China. What are we doing to make sure?
Yeah, it's on page 113, right. Members, under agency overview.
So, Mr. Chairman, as you can see, there are no specific monitoring points on the coast.
On the coast.
But I think
say.
We can answer that question for you where we do have monitoring.
Okay, very good. Representative.
Yeah, forgive me, Stephanie. It's the water ambient. It's ambient water quality map that I can't read very well. I'm sorry. Forgive me.
We're going to have a beautiful one up on the screen for you.
Thank you very
much.
Because
we couldn't read it either.
Okay. Senator Bates.
Just a point here. You touched on the difficulty in certain local airsheds and the problems we have with that yet, being from the Rogue Valley and the controversy we've gone through in there in the last 2 years, which was just got people at the throats. It determined a couple of local elections, and it's still not completely resolved. This was a really nasty thing in our community, and it's as a result of our airshed being entrapped in the wintertime and in summer sometimes, and decisions being made about industrial air pollution as well as car pollution. I just want to point out that in some parts of the state, we've got a lot more problems than this might indicate, and it's still a very, very hot item and has not resolved. The DEQ got caught right in the middle of it, as you may well understand. And we still don't know how everyone feels down there about the final decisions that were made or whether the decisions are going to hold up.
That's correct.
And you'll be seeing legislation being offered from the body that directly responds to some of those issues yet.
And that actually, Senator Bates and Mr. Chairman, goes to the point that Senator Nelson was making earlier, because for those of you who were not familiar with what happened in Southern Oregon, we had actually proposed to relax some of the environmental, because of the reduction in air pollution, some of the restrictions to allow more economic development, and there was an overwhelming reaction from the community that they did not want those requirements relaxed, and so they were not. But it was one of those classic discussions that one has.
I would further point out that I think in this particular situation, the DEQ did the best job it could, but I think they were out of step with the community and didn't realize it until they were quite a ways down the road. Even a lot of the industrial customers would have been affected by this. Many of them did not want those relaxed.
It affects our entire community. I think the what you might take away from this is Oregon is not looking for a relaxation of air pollution standards, especially in areas like the Rogue Valley where we have serious problems. So I would guess that's probably been sort of pounded into your heads, unfortunately.
Senator Bates, that was in fact the message we took away from that experience.
And you're continuing to make certain they're aware of that, Senator.
Well, I'm just trying to mollify some people on both sides of this issue because I got caught in the middle of it, too. So.
Yeah, it's always fun to be shot out on both sides. Yes, Representative.
Thank you. So in that community, clearly that wouldn't work. Is it just always going to be a statewide policy, or will you be flexible, or how are you going to deal with that?
Representative Schaffler and Mr. Chairman, actually, this was not a discussion about a statewide policy. What we do, these clean air plans that I mentioned, those are actually developed regionally to address the specific problems in a specific area. So it will depend.
Okay, very good. Please
okay,
continue.
I'll move on to water quality. DEQ's water quality program protects both surface and groundwater for beneficial uses, and those include drinking water, industrial water supplies, fisheries, wildlife, agriculture, recreation, and aesthetics. We have more than 100,000 miles of rivers, 6,200 lakes, 9 major estuaries, and 360 coastal miles in Oregon. Groundwater, of course, is less visible but extremely important. More than 90% of available fresh water in the state is groundwater. And 70% of all Oregonians and more than 90% of rural Oregonians rely on groundwater as their primary or secondary drinking water source. What we do at DEQ to protect water quality is first we develop standards. Then we set pollution limits, and you may have heard those referenced as the TMDLs, or total maximum daily loads of pollution, and that just means how much pollution can a water body handle. We monitor in water just as we do in air. Of course, we do issue and enforce permits. There are about 4,000 municipal and industrial permitted facilities for water. We regulate and inspect septic system installations. And we work with others to protect drinking water. We actually do not have the primary authority for the drinking water program. That resides in the health division. We do offer low-cost loans to upgrade sewage treatment plants, as I mentioned earlier. And then we also control so-called non-point sources of pollution, which is basically runoff, urban and rural runoff, and there's a combination of incentives and regulation used to control that pollution. Our major budget and legislative initiative that you'll hear about in this committee is to improve water quality. We have two specific proposals, and we'll be talking with you later about those. One is a budget proposal and a piece of legislation directed at our wastewater permitting program to reduce the permit backlog, to have stable funding, and make program improvements on into the future. We also have a budget package that does not have legislation attached to it that continues resources for cleaning up the Willamette River. And in other parts of this discussion, we'll be getting into those in depth with you. But I just wanted to alert you that it's about water for us this session.
And that is, Stephanie, because last session was it that you had a fairly substantial reduction in your air program, also in terms of personnel?
Mr. Chairman, we have a reduction in our air program this time in the governor's rec. We also had reductions in air, water, and land leading up to this session. And most of our general fund is in water, so we've actually taken more reductions in water. The real reason that it is, there are two reasons that we have the priority this session. One is that when I became the director, I had three major initiatives that I wanted to undertake, and I'll be talking more about them later, but this was one of them. The wastewater permitting program has been in trouble since I've been at DEQ, and I've been there for 16 years. I mean, we've been running permit backlogs, on and on and on, and I just said, we're going to fix it. If I'm not going to do anything else as director, we're going to fix this program. So we convened an advisory committee over the last 2 years that has worked with us and helped create this proposal that we're bringing to you this session.
And the other piece of that is, and we'll get into that again in phase two, but is the additional FTEs positions for the Willamette TMDL, the implementation of that.
That's
which, of
correct.
Course, is a governor's priority.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, very good. Please continue.
Okay, this map, which is also in your binder and is illegible in your binder, so now here we present it so you can read it, shows that how our work has actually improved water quality in the state. And, Mr. Chairman, you just referred to the TMDLs, and this is where I'm going to talk about that a bit. What we do is that we work around the state to develop these plans.
Tiffany, just
yes.
Briefly again, for the record, state what TMDL means.
I did it.
That's okay. We have all been...
Is it a quarter?
No.
Okay.
No.
Total maximum daily loads.
And that is a measurement of what?
That is a measurement of how much pollution, when you do a plan for a particular water body, how much pollution can that water body absorb and still meet water quality standards.
Very good. Thank you. Yeah, Senator Nelson.
I'm having this clarification because in my part of the country, I have several people that refer to TMDLs as too many damn lawyers.
Good, I'll have to remember that.
Let's keep that on the record. I like that. That's pretty good, Senator. All right, please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We are working around the state, as I said, to develop these plans wherever we have water quality problems. Now, on this map, the dots that you see are long-term monitoring sites throughout the state. Some of these sites indeed are long-term. They've been there since the late 1940s, and they provide data to determine whether or not the water quality is improving. The stars on the map are 10 sites that are showing the greatest improvement in water quality between 1990 and 2003. And 9 out of those 10 sites are in 4 watersheds where we do have clean water plans, or TMDL, total maximum daily load plans, that have been adopted and implemented. And those watersheds include the Tualatin, the Columbia Slough, the Yamhill, and Bear Creek. This map does not show all the watersheds where we have clean water plans or TMDL plans that have been adopted. But in general, water quality has improved across the state since the late 1980s, and improvements have consistently been greatest in watersheds with adopted clean water plans, or TMDLs. So we really do have some good data to show that this program is effective.
Question for you, Stephanie, and again, we'll get into this later. You're fairly well on track to complete the TMDLs, which has been ordered by the court by 2010, correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
And with your budget proposals you have before us, you feel pretty confident you'll be able to achieve that.
Mr. Chairman, I will discuss this in depth when we talk about performance measures, but I am nervous at this point with the cuts that we have taken in the water program up till now. And when we get in the 10% reduction list that you are considering this time, the court order date is 2010. And one of the things that we have discussed, if there are further reductions in the TMDL program, to make that date, quite frankly, what we've talked about is one of the reasons we've been able to move forward successfully is we've had a lot of public process. We have a TMDL advisory committee. Every place we're working on one, and it's very resource intensive, and we may have to cut back on some of that, but I will get into that in greater detail. So we prioritize there are certain requirements of the consent agreement that make us prioritize some over others. And we feel pretty confident we can get those done. But we are under consent agreement to get them all done by 2010. So.
Representative Dinkle.
Thank you. And having worked on the first TMD that was adopted in the state, which was the Tualatin Basin, and spent many, many, many hours bringing parties together, I just want to clarify, when you say the TMDLs are done, Stephanie, you mean the actual plans are adopted? Because there's the implementation phase, and I don't think a lot of people really understand that, and I know I didn't until I worked on it, you know, what the difference is, and so you may want to clarify that for the committee.
Thank you, Representative Dingfelder. That's exactly correct. We have to have all the plans completed and submitted to EPA for approval by 2010. The actions to implement them are really done by the people to whom the plans apply, the permitted sources or the non-point sources. And as an example of the effectiveness in the Tualatin Basin, we have 5 monitoring sites, and for example, Tualatin at Boone's Ferry Road, we have seen 103% improvement in the water quality index as a result of having a total maximum daily load plan for that area. So the implementation is absolutely critical if you want to see results, and the package that we're asking for, Mr. Chairman, is specific to the Willamette. That TMDL is out on public comment now, and hopefully will be approved and completed, and then there is, in fact, the implementation effort for a huge subbasin, because the Willamette TMDL covers the whole Willamette subbasin, which is very complex and very large.
Okay. Senator Bates?
Just kind of put things in context for me, because this is an area that's fairly new to me. And what I know of it is fragmentary, so I'm going to ask a few questions, and if it takes too much time in the committee, I can ask you in private. TMDLs, are they basically designed so that if they were totally implemented, you'd be in a situation if you had a major storm or something of that nature, you would no longer have raw sewage going into streams, you'd be taking care of industrial pollutants. I mean, are these set up in such a way that these are sort of the best-case scenarios so that you can take care of water quality if they're implemented?
The short answer, Senator Bates, is yes. However, there is a symbiotic, shall we say, relationship between a total maximum daily load and a permit, because the permit is actually the vehicle for a discharging source that sets the limits. The TMDL says this is how much this river can take, and for the permit says, based on that, this is how much this individual source is allowed to discharge. Now, maybe I should just stop there, because did that help at all?
I think we need to have the conversation in private. I mean, one of the things I'm really driving at is living out where we do in Southern Oregon. If you happen to have to put a septic system into your property, the water coming out of the septic system has to be drinkable. I mean, they have sand filters that you have to be so pure you're drinkable. We get hammered for not being environmentally sensitive in Southern Oregon, being representatives down there. And yet when I look at Portland, where everyone is environmentally sensitive and get high rankings for being environmentally sensitive, their water's a mess. The Willamette River's a mess. They haven't got the TMLD done yet. And I just can't quite put that connection between what they're saying there and what they're doing compared to what we're saying down south and what we're doing.
Mr. Chairman,
Bear Creek is a good example of, you know, we're a rural area, but we've taken care of our problems, we hope. And certainly if you're not on a major sewer system in Southern Oregon, your problems are monitored very carefully, very tightly, and you can spend $20,000 or $30,000 very quickly getting a sand filter put in. So I mean, it's like it's tight in one area of the state, but up in Portland I don't quite understand what's going on sometimes.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bates, is it okay to take time to address that now, or would you?
Yeah, if
I don't want to slow. Why don't we do it in private?
The next couple of minutes would be great.
Well, I'll try. First of all, let me assure you that the rules apply the same statewide. And in Portland's case, there's actually an additional thing going on. They are under an order from the Environmental Quality Commission that says they have to solve this combined sewer outfall problem by 2011. And as I'm sure you know, they are spending millions and billions of dollars to do that, which to which I am contributing as a resident of the city of Portland. And they are on schedule to do that. But during the time that they are building this massive project, they do, in fact, have permitted, allowed overflows, for lack of a better term, in wet weather events. And that is a fact because they're constructing this huge system. But that we statewide strive to not have those overflows and apply the same set of rules everywhere. And I also want to clarify that the septic program is different in that, first of all, the City of Portland and other folks who have a permit to discharge directly into a surface water source, whether it's a stream or whatever it is, those discharges do not have to meet drinking water standards. They meet clean water standards, the federal standards, but they're not drinking water standards. And they're regulated by the permit. The septic program, in theory, is a zero discharge program. I mean, that's why the water is cleaned up through the filter system so clean. I mean, it is not supposed to be going to ground, or if it is going to groundwater, because a lot of people drink groundwater, it's got to be super clean. It's not supposed to be discharging into the river. So there's a difference between the septic program and permitted surface water discharges. And also the City of Portland is under this unique order from the commission and potentially enforcement from EPA, as you probably know as well.
Yes, please. My question is, like, if I put a new septic system on rural Clackamas County, it'd be the exact same standards as if it was down next to Senator Bates's.
That's correct, Representative Shoffler.
Thank you.
Good.
Yes,
What issues do you have when you cross federal lands? Since Oregon is 62% or whatever it is owned by federal lands, does that cause you any problems?
With regard to water quality,
how you administer the program? Do the feds come in and say trump you at some point?
No, we do. And tell me if I'm not answering this correctly. Our relationship with the U.S. EPA, of course, all the programs that we administer on their behalf, they always have authority, if they don't like something we're doing, to come in and take an action of their own. That's the part of the arrangement with the federal government. And as a matter of fact, I just mentioned the City of Portland. That's one that they actually have done that. And there are other examples. I'm sure you're aware of the one in Northeast Oregon a few years ago. So
you have federal lands involved, but you administer them on federal lands, basically. Or
Paul's giving me a hint.
Go ahead, Paul.
I think what the senator is asking is, as a source of pollution, do they have to comply with the TMDL requirements or those kinds of requirements?
Okay.
That's all part of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, can I just give an example in the Tualatin? And we didn't have a lot of federal land, but BLM was part of the process of setting the TMDL. So anybody, you know, feds, state, any other agencies have to comply with the same regulations. That's my
Holly, for the record. Holly, state your name, please.
For the record, my name is Holly Schroeder. I'm the administrator of the Water Quality Program. Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, what you've said is correct. We work with partners, and in the TMDL document, we identify what are called designated management agencies, which are sort of the responsible parties for carrying out a lot of the implementation activities, and agencies such as the Bureau of Land Management or U.S. Forest Service are often assigned to be designated management agencies in our TMDLs.
Great, thank you. Please continue. We need to move on.
All right, we'll move on to land quality. The land quality program protects human health and the environment through a group of separate but related activities. Chemical spills of all types pose a threat to people's health and the environment, and our emergency response folks are on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, whether the call comes from a derailed train or something we hope never happens, a catastrophic event associated with terrorist activities. In 2004, we responded to more than 2,300 emergency notifications from the Oregon Emergency Response System. This photo is a truck accident south of Ashland, which spilled the herbicide 2,4-D and affected Carter Creek. We coordinated the on-scene response.
Yes.
Thank you. What exactly would make up an emergency notification? is there a certain quantity of stuff, or is it the type of chemical or pollutant? What triggers an emergency notification?
There, Representative Schaffler, Al Kippett can give you the actual specifics. I believe there are de minimis amounts, but we will get a call. What the real trigger is do you go out for everything? We can get a notification of practically everything, but you don't always go out on scene. Obviously, for something like this, we would.
Al, why don't you come up just briefly and for the record, state your name, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Alan Kippett, Manager, Division Administrator for the Land Quality Division. Representative Schaffler, in terms of notifications, there's the Oregon Emergency Response System, where all spills or events like this are called in. And what we do is then evaluate those, look at which ones need to be actually followed up on, and determine whether or not it's a de minimis amount, less than 50 gallons of oil or whatever, and determine whether we need an on-scene coordinator to be at that site or if a local emergency management group is already there.
And it doesn't mean that it doesn't get cleaned up. It's a difference before whether you guys come down and supervise it or a local agency does it.
Correct.
It's really the difference.
Right.
Isn't it, I was in the fire service, is it 5 gallons or less doesn't trigger anything, or has that standard changed?
That's a correct standard for oil.
For oil, okay. Mr. Chairman. Fuel is different, though.
Right.
Yeah, okay. Very good. Thank you all.
Appreciate it.
Okay, please continue.
Okay, the next component that Land Quality Program oversees is the cleanup program, and I've mentioned that a bit, where we clean up sites contaminated by toxic substances. And since 1988, more than 25,000 sites around the state have been identified as contaminated with toxic substances. And as you'll see when we talk about performance measures, cleanup has been completed or is underway at 90% of those sites, and that includes both leaking tank sites and other hazard sites. This, of course, is Portland Harbor. This is contamination from an old oil and gas plant that operated until the 1950s. The land next to the river is contaminated with tar from those operations. Excuse me. This, of course, has been probably the highest profile example of the work that we do. Portland Harbor is a federal Superfund site, and we share the work on cleaning up Portland Harbor with the U.S. EPA. They're in the lead for the so-called in-water work, which is cleaning up the sediment in the river, and then we work with all of the businesses and property owners along the banks of the river for cleanup along the riverbank. As I mentioned earlier, we also regulate the disposal of the chemical weapons in Senator Nelson's district, that the Umatilla Chemical Agent Disposal Facility, which is near Hermiston. Starting in September of 2004, the first chemical weapons and nerve agents started to get destroyed. The total stockpile is more than 220,000 munitions and containers of chemical agent, and more than 7.4 million pounds of agent. We have 12% of the nation's stockpile at Umatilla. It's nerve agent and blister agent. And this picture is a one-ton container. It's called an ONC, another acronym, and I unfortunately can't tell you what it stands for. I probably knew somewhere in time. But it's full of rockets that contain sarin gas, and they're actually moving them. They take them out of the igloos that you see if you drive by the Umatilla Army Depot. They load them into the ONCs, and then the ONCs are transported into the facility, and then they're unloaded by robotics and go through the process. In this program, we also regulate safe management of hazardous and solid wastes. We regulate 550 hazardous waste generators and 5 hazardous waste facilities. And we also provide, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of technical assistance to small businesses on how to safely manage their wastes. We regulate almost 6,000 currently operating underground storage tanks and 384 landfills and other kinds of solid waste management facilities, transfer stations, that sort of thing. We have, and that is the Coffin Butte landfill that you see that just came up on that slide. We also have the waste prevention and recycling program, where we try and reduce toxic waste and solid waste through recycling. In 2003, the recycling rate for Oregon was 47.3%, which actually exceeds our goal of 45% for 2005. The problem is that while we're doing pretty well recycling, we're continuing to generate a lot of waste. And so we have some concern as to whether or not Oregon will be able to meet its 50% recycling rate by 2009.
Stephanie, a question about, and again, reading back through ALFO's narrative here, it's talking about you had a fee increase for hazardous waste, I believe in 03-05. Because you've disposal of hazardous waste had began declining significantly during 01-03. Two questions. Why the decline, and do you expect it to continue?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to ask Al to answer the do you expect it to continue question, because I don't know the answer. But what happened is that, first of all, the revenue that we're talking about comes from disposal of hazardous waste in Arlington at the hazardous waste landfill run by Chem Waste Management. And the reason that the amount of waste declined going in was because of the end, I think, in the Pacific Northwest of the aluminum industry. And the waste that was generated was called potliner, and it was a huge waste stream for that landfill, and it basically went away. And because of that, that revenue, there's a fee attached to it that comes to the state for our hazardous waste program and also for part of our cleanup program. That revenue had declined dramatically. And that, so we got together with the stakeholders, and that's where we figured out a fee increase that was enacted last session. Now, as to whether or not it's expected to decline, is there a yes or no answer? Probably not. Do you want to come up for a second?
For the record, again, I'm Alan Kibbett, Commissioner Administrator for Land Quality Division. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't think there's a very clear answer on that in terms of the economy of the state of Oregon and the way business is being run. To the extent that we see efficiencies or improvements in how hazardous waste is controlled or limited in terms of its generation, they may go down. But we don't have a good handle on forecasting that right now.
Okay.
I'm sure, Mr. Chairman, that Dave Barrows could come in and speak to you on that issue at some point, since he represents the
company.
I'm sure
he probably will. The other question I want to have, and I thank you, Alan, and that I want to would like to have you touch on is the orphan site program, and kind of share with us what that is, and then outline for us. Well, I guess Alan's back.
Well, we're going to see how I do, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, okay.
I may need help.
And just kind of lay out what that orphan site program is, and then answer for me how big of a problem do we have with orphan sites, and how big and how long it's going to take us to fix it.
Okay, Mr. Chairman. I'll take the first crack at that. The orphan site program is part of the cleanup program, and basically all orphan site means is there is no what we refer to as a responsible party to clean it up. They're either unwilling or unable to pay for the cleanup. And that means that somebody else has to, either the state or the federal government. So that's what the orphan site program is. And we, in those cleanup numbers that I gave you, a fair number of those were orphan site cleanups. We have funded orphan site cleanup through the sale of bonds here in Oregon. And we've not had authority to sell those bonds recently, and so there is some concern about having sufficient funds for future orphan site cleanup.
Hey, how come you haven't had the authority to sell
well,
the bonds.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I believe that's because you have not given it to us.
And it's probably because we have to repay that with general fund dollars, and they have been scarce in the last
That's correct,
couple
Mr.
Years.
Chair. Okay. The debt has traditionally been serviced by the general fund. We will be discussing in our reduction options a proposal for a one-time servicing of debt from another funding source this go-round.
Yeah, and we'll get into that in phase two, members, because this is a fascinating funding mechanism with orphan sites, and it's a bit confusing, and you'll need to probably take some time to answer our questions on it. Alan, how big a problem is this, and how do we fix it, and when do we fix it?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I wish I had a great simple answer for that one. Right now we've got, I think, somewhere over 50 active orphan projects that we're working on. An example is Kaiser area here. We had 50 or so homes that were drinking water supplies were impacted, could not identify the source of that contamination, needed orphan funds to do that. We've used orphan funds for some assessment work on abandoned mines, which are huge, expensive projects that we really can't expect the state to pay for that. We're looking for federal money for those kind of projects. The difficulty is orphan projects crop up every year. There's no way to predict how many might come in the door at any given time, but the program is designed to address the worst of the contamination sites. They're supposed to be high priority sites, and as Dr. Halleck mentioned, there's no responsibility or no responsible party known or that we're able to find that has the money to pay for those sites, and that's the real problem, is whether or not we're going to run into a situation a year and a half, 2 years from now, where we have no money in the orphan account, and we've got sites out there that are posing serious threat to public health or the environment.
And Mr. Chair, if I may add one thing with regard to the future you asked about, the federal government and the federal superfund in 1995, they did away with the tax on business that funded the federal superfund, so that is declining as well in terms of having federal dollars.
And do you have a backlog of orphan site projects right now? And if so, how big?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we don't have a backlog of orphan sites at this point. What we've done, given the situation of not having a bond sale to further the program, we're looking at the money we have in the account now, determining what immediate actions we need to take on all of the projects that we know of, and scaling back on some work so that we can at least make sure we don't have any imminent threats out there that we know of.
Thank you very much, Alan. Appreciate it. Please continue.
Mr. Chairman, I only have two more entities to discuss and two more slides for this section. I want to move to the laboratory. This picture, there it is, shows our DEQ lab workers. They are in a specially constructed room that we have recently put in the lab for analysis of unknown chemicals. Of course, we do ambient monitoring and analysis of Oregon's air and water, but our lab is also, and our land, excuse me, our lab is also used by first responders and law enforcement to analyze any unknown substance that's brought to them, and those would include anything from a credible terrorist threat. Our lab is co-located with the public health lab, and we work collaboratively with the public health lab. And, of course, the data that we use really are the foundation for the work that we do. We use the data to determine whether or not environmental standards have been met, to provide compliance information for our inspections, to help investigate events involving unknown pollutants, as I alluded to, and to support civil and criminal investigations. And, of course, our lab staff are highly technical. They do scientific and technical assistance in the areas of environmental chemistry, biological assessments, air and water measurements, analytical methods, and quality assurance. We also work in partnerships with private laboratories in Oregon, with the Public Health Lab and the Oregon Department of Agriculture. We provide voluntary accreditation of environmental laboratories which meet national performance standards. And there are currently about 35 labs in Oregon that have been accredited through this program. Our lab does the basic lab work and does some work that only we can do by regulation, but we do contract out lab work that can legally be done so where it's cost effective to do it. An example is in Al Kippett's program, in the cleanup program, where we use a contract lab for sample analysis. And that's really all I had to say about the lab, unless you have any questions.
Good.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The last part of the organization I want to cover in the agency overview is our agency management, which is the meat and potatoes, if you will, of the agency. They contain our human resources folks, health and safety, information management, accounting, budget, and the director's office as well. We also have the pollution control tax credit program housed in the management services division. And what I'd really like, since most of you, I'm sure, are familiar with these basic kinds of activities, I'd like to just highlight some of the streamlining accomplishments that agency management has undertaken over the past couple of years. First of all, we just received notice that for the 14th consecutive year, we've received a Gold Star Award from the State Controller's Division for excellence and timeliness in year-end financial reporting. We have a long history. Our accounting and business office has a long history of very good audits and opinions from the various state and federal auditors, and I just can't say enough good things about Judy Hatton, who runs that shop, and her continuing excellent performance. In terms of general fund savings, and this was alluded to a few minutes ago a little bit by the debt service for the orphan site bonds, our budget shop and our bond whiz, Isla Robertson, initiated a number of actions to take advantage of lower interest rates to reduce our general fund needed for debt service on some of the bonds that were outstanding. So we, in 03-05, we lowered by nearly $6.2 million the general fund needed to service the debt. And over the next 20 years, if you extrapolate that out, it would save the state nearly $40 million in general fund expenditures. Our IT folks have been working with a number of our programs to initiate more online reporting for the people with whom we do business. One particular system this biennium, we built a system allowing hazardous waste generators to report online, and we did that under a cooperative agreement with the state of Washington, and so we paid half of what it would have otherwise cost to do that, and it makes it much easier for our hazardous waste generators to complete these complex forms, and it helps us provide better customer service to them and allows them to do business more quickly online. And then finally, an example, we, as you can imagine, have a lot of public interest in what we do, and we have historically had, I think, over 18,000 names on a paper mailing list, and we have gone to a complete email system for updating that mailing list and being able to distribute documents. Of course, people can get paper documents if they need them, but we will. I think we last estimated that we would be reducing at least $25,000 a year worth of cost because of that. Mr. Chairman, I will stop there on the program overview and move to performance measures or whatever you wish.
That's what's up next, is it?
That's not the board.
Get us on the right page.
All right. You need to turn to Appendix Roman numeral 1-3, which is looks like this. These are our 15 legislatively adopted performance measures. I'm going to say a few words, and then I'm going to start on page 6 of that attachment with performance measure number 1 and walk you through those. Basically, let me just say that the purpose of our performance measures is to track environmental results, internal efficiencies, and customer service. We have some benchmarks associated with our performance measures. Those benchmarks, of course, are tracked by the Oregon Progress Board. The ones that I'm going to review with you today are 15 that were approved by the 2003 legislature. We also, within each of our programs, we have additional measures that they use to guide their work every day and to fulfill commitments to the Environmental Protection Agency. 11 of our performance measures track environmental results. four-track internal efficiencies, three-track customer service. There is some overlap among those, and I'll talk about that as we go through them. So that's what I'm going to do starting right now, Mr. Chairman, if that's okay with you.
That's fine.
All right, and we will start from the top with performance measure number one. This performance measure supports our strategic priority of delivering excellence in performance and product by assessing customer satisfaction with permitting. We have contracted for three customer service surveys of air and water permittees and homeowners who obtain septic permits. The first survey was in 2002. The 2004 survey results are in your binders at tab Roman numeral I-2. It's a different tab than this one. And the next survey will be in 2006. The 2004 survey that we're talking about now has showed several broad program improvements, such as overall satisfaction with our air program, which increased from 71% in 2002 to 80% in 2004, and our septic program, which increased from 61% to 77% satisfaction. However, this performance measure tells us that the percentage of customers who said that we were meeting or exceeding their expectations just specific to permit application and review stayed at 65%, and we did not achieve our goal of 75% for 2004. And basically what that tells us is that we have more work to do in improving our permitting processes in air and water. And I've talked to you a little bit about the wastewater permitting problems that we hope what we're submitting to you this session will solve for us. In air quality, we did some program efficiencies, that some of which have kicked in, and there are some more to kick in, which we hope will help. We also have created an annual inspectors forum in air quality where businesses are invited to give feedback about service and air quality. In water quality, I mentioned that we've developed a service quality pledge for our permit holders. And we're also working in both of these programs to get more of these services online for folks. But this is clearly an area where we need to do some work. We want to get up from 65%, which has been constant since 2002. And what the 65% is meeting or exceeding your expectations.
Stephanie, because of the very type of work that you do, is that the reason that you can get there, you think?
Representative Krieger, that is a very interesting question. You will note on page 7, in the very last paragraph, there is a sentence that is now incorrect. It says, this paragraph is entitled, "What Needs to Be Done as a Result of This Analysis?" And you read the first sentence, and at the end of the first line, it says, DEQ has revised its target for 2006 back to 65%, in essence, which we have not done. We're holding at 75%. But the reason that that was in there and even being discussed is exactly the point that you're making. The consultant who did these surveys for us said, in fact, that the degree of satisfaction that we are getting is very good, and advised us that they, quite frankly, don't know that we can improve it. But, you know, my feeling is we should still try.
Kind of like trying to get the IRS to that degree.
That would be one analogy.
They'd love to have that figure, wouldn't they?
I'll move on to the next measure if there's no further questions.
And Mr. Chair, I wonder what the legislature's performance would be if we surveyed it.
Wouldn't be 65% right now.
I'm just curious.
What'd you bring that up for?
Just causing trouble, trying to wake everybody up, including me.
Go ahead, Stephanie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Performance measure number two, maybe this will be more interesting to me.
Well,
this is about enforcement, Representative Schaffler.
Mr. Chair, forgive me, Stephanie. This time of day, if I'm not moving around, I'm hard to stay awake. So
I
forgive
understand.
Me. It's nothing to do with subject matter.
I understand, Representative Schaffler. I know it's fascinating.
If you snort out loud, I'll bug you.
Okay.
Performance measure number two does, in fact, address the improvements that we're trying to make in our enforcement program. When I became the director, I mentioned already that one of my priorities was to improve the wastewater permitting program. My other two major priorities were to improve the service in the septic program, which we've done, and to ensure that we have an understandable and equitable enforcement program. With the support of our Environmental Quality Commission, we embarked a few years ago on an ambitious effort to completely revamp our enforcement rules. I optimistically thought that we would complete this in about a year, but given the public interest and the complexity of the rules, we have had to split the rulemaking into two parts. The Commission did, in fact, adopt phase one of the rules at the end of 2004, and our goal is to adopt the second part of the rule changes by the end of this year. But I will be totally honest with you that I will be surprised if completion of that does not slip into the first part of 2006, because some of the toughest issues have been deferred to this part of the rulemaking, such as the classification of violations and the magnitude, and there will be many, many conversations with interested public about these issues. Any questions about that?
Getting by easy.
Okay. We have 13 more to go, Mr. Chairman. Performance measures number 3 and number 4, these also relate to permitting, and they're also the same as Oregon benchmark number 10. While the first performance measure that I talked to you about permitting dealt with customer satisfaction, measures number 3 and number 4 tell us how fast we're actually getting the permits out the door. For measure number 3, the Progress Board approved a target of 85% timely air contaminant discharge permits by 2005. And we have actually surpassed that goal since 2001. We did have a slight dip in timeliness in those air permits in 2003, but it's a normal. We think it's a normal variation in the data and does not reflect a trend that you'll see. For water permits, which is number 4, the Progress Board approved a goal of 40% timely permits for 2005. While we had achieved that goal as early as 2001, we were still running high backlogs in the water permits. And because we were focusing on trying to get rid of the backlog, that kept us from raising that 40% target, which is really not where we want to be. We want to issue many, many more permits on time than that. And I'm going to talk about the permit backlog more when we get to performance measure number 8. If there are no questions on permitting, I'll move on.
Thank you. Are you going to talk about why that's such a backlog at number 8, or what's causing the backlog and the lack of timeliness we're providing these permits?
Representative Schaffler, Mr. Chairman, the backlog probably predates me, so it is longstanding. It is a combination of things, and our advisory committee addressed all of them, both in the legislation that we're proposing this time and the policy package. Part of it is the old resource story. I mean, it's just not having enough people to do the work. But that is not the only reason. We have committed to making many more efficiencies in how we operate the program. One of those efficiencies is issuing more general permits as opposed to individual permits. And what general permits are source category permits. So if you are in a particular type of category that you get, there's a particular permit for that category, costs less money, and you just get that same permit as everybody else, rather than having to go out, assess that individual situation, write a special permit just for that one source. So there would be more of those. Another improvement would be to do what we call watershed-based permitting. That's where you look at all the permits, you target your watersheds that have the highest, most problems, and you look at all the permits in that area at one time. And so that also achieves some environmental benefits as well as some efficiencies in how you do your permitting. So we do have a request that involves resources. We are committed to making more efficiencies. And there have also been some changes in the federal requirements that have brought more people into the system as well.
Stephanie, on page 10 and 12, underneath your target, you've got 85% and 205, and then down below you don't have anything there. And the same on the other page. And on out to 6 and 07.
Mr. Chair, Director, I think what we're looking for is if you have, do you have targets, do you know, established for 2006 and 2007 for these measures? Because I know they're benchmarks and that the Progress Board sets targets for 2010, but we'll be in the process of doing performance measures, approving targets for 2006 and 2007.
Mr. Chairman, I do not know the answer to that question. If anybody on my staff knows the answer to that question, please step forward now. If not, we'll get back to you. Nobody's stepping forward, so we'll have to get back to you.
But
I do.
Information back to
I will, Mr. Chair. I can tell you that our goal with regard to the permit backlog is to reduce the permit backlog to a backlog of 10%, which I will talk about when I get to Measure 8, by 2007. By 2007.
And Stephanie, could you reference the pages that you're on in a difference in addition to the performance measure? Sometimes we're looking back.
Okay.
At the bottom there's a page.
Gotcha. Yeah, I mean, yes, I will.
Gotcha's okay, Stephanie. It's all right.
She's pretty easy with it, isn't she?
On the gotcha side, is that right?
She's at ease with it.
That's good.
All right, now we have, or I have just finished addressing performance measure number 3 and performance measure number 4, which conclude at the bottom of page 13. And I will move on, if you are ready to do so, to page 14, which is performance measure.
Before you do,
yes,
because I've been out visiting with my staff on constituent issues.
I'm getting
by the way, this is the there's a rolling cart going around the building selling root beer floats or orange floats for the governor's food drive. They're only $1. If you see them, please partake. And I got hit up outside the door, so I haven't been out, you know, playing hooky down at cafe today. Paul, were we able to ask any additional questions about the first three performance measures, yes, what you and I talked about previously?
I believe so. If you have some things that you want to make sure are covered, but I think they've been covered. Yep, we covered them.
You did?
Things are good. And then,
you got that done? Okay. We're on number 3 now, is that correct?
We just finished those.
We just finished number 3, and so... Okay, on number 3, I wanted to ask a question. See, I've been doing my homework here. Why, in 2004, there's no data, and it says you won't have 2004 data until January 2005. Well, this is February. 2005. So, do you have the data quite yet for that?
Were you getting ready to say something?
Nope.
Oh, okay.
No, he's not going to bail. Yeah.
Okay. Let's see if anyone left me a note here so I could answer that question, and they didn't. So I don't know the answer to that question. Does anyone?
But I
know
bet you'll get the answer for me tomorrow, won't you?
We're working on it, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you very much. All right. Let's go to performance measure number 4. Okay, same thing. You're going to do targets? Okay, good deal. And I wanted to ask you, 2005, why is there a 40% target? Why is that so low, or is that what you think is the right target, or should it be higher?
Mr. Chairman, I do think it should be higher, and the reason it is low, we discussed a bit while you were out of the room, and I'll talk about more when we get to performance measure 8. It is because we have been running such a huge permit backlog that we are trying to address by the proposals that we are bringing to you this session, that we have not been able to get that number up any higher. We definitely want it higher. We hope that the proposals that we will bring to you will do that. And some of the reasons that I was sharing with the committee about why the backlog has gone on for such a long time is a combination of us needing to be more efficient, a combination, and I gave some examples of those efficiencies, which I'd be happy to go over again or share with you. And we do have some resource problems, and that's one of the reasons we're bringing the proposals to you this session. And there have been, through changes in law, more sources brought in under the permitting umbrella. So it's been a combination of factors. But absolutely, it's not satisfactory.
Okay, very good. We'll move on to number five then.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Performance measure number five, which starts on page 14, and performance measure number six, which starts on page 16, really go together. Both support our strategic priority of protecting Oregon's water by setting those famous TMDLs, or pollutant loads, for certain watersheds in accordance with the consent agreement, 2000 consent agreement that I mentioned earlier. Measure number five tells us how we're doing in making sure that we complete these TMDLs or clean water plans for a certain number of water bodies that were identified specifically in the consent agreement, and those must be done by 2010. Measure five measures our project toward meeting the numbers in the consent. Measure five helps tell us how we're doing in making sure that we complete. I might have said that backwards. Okay. Measure five, I'll just do this on my own.
Okay,
I'm trying to read my own notes. five tells us in the consent agreement, as I mentioned earlier, there were certain water bodies that had to be done first. And measure five tells us how we are doing on getting those done. And as I said earlier, we will make those a priority to make sure they get done. Measure six tells us whether or not these clean water plans are addressing all water quality problems in these watersheds. And that relates back to that map that I showed you earlier. So we have one measure that tells us how we're doing on measure five on meeting the consent agreement, and measure six then that tells us how we're doing in actually improving water quality.
Okay, I would ask you to give us a better explanation than what's on the page. It's actually one of the questions I have is number five says cumulative percentage of water body segments. So define segments. Are segments waterways? Are they portions of rivers and tributaries? That needs some further explanation, I think.
I will, Mr. Chairman. They're actually all of the above. Total maximum daily loads are actually set for different pieces of water bodies, sometimes for whole water bodies. It depends on the area that has been identified that does not meet water quality standards, and that can vary across the state. But we will use more clear terminology.
Yes, Representative Schaffler.
I had imagined the goal is to be 100%. So can you explain why, the trend has been going up, and then you anticipate it to be going down to 27%. Why is that? And then why is on the next one, you have really small percentages, and then all of a sudden you're going to make a big jump from 17% up to 49%. Just explain to me how that...
Representative Schaffler, I'm going to ask Holly Schroeder, the Water Quality Program Administrator, to come and answer, because I think she'll give much more thorough answers than I can.
Holly, again, for the record.
For the record, my name is Holly Schroeder. I'm an Administrator of the Water Quality Division at DEQ. Representative Schaffler, Mr. Chair, on Performance Measure 5, the targets that have been set, the 2004 target and 5 targets, are targets that are derived from the consent order that we are operating under. We also have targets in that consent order established for 2008 and for 2010. And so in working with the Progress Board, we wanted to be sure that we were measuring our legal compliance there. We've surpassed those measures. As you can see, we in 2004, we are currently at 38%, so we've exceeded that target.
Good, thank you. And then
yes, go ahead.
And then the next one, that's the same explanation for the next, for number six, too.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shuffler, number six is a little bit different in that, as Director Halleck indicated, it's really trying to identify whether or not we're addressing all of the water quality problems in this area that we're talking about. And it's a slightly different set universe that we're looking at than what has been specified by the consent order. So the reason I believe, and I will confirm this, that we have looked at a potential drop in that is that every 2 years we do an update to our impaired waters list. And that's a factor in this. And we do those in even-numbered years. And so I think we're trying to anticipate what's happening in terms of trending over that. And I can confirm that information for you.
Thank you. Question. And on number five, the verbiage that you're using is cumulative percentage of water body segments approved. So, and I'm a little confused here. So, am I supposed to read that if all your water bodies that need TMDLs are determined to be 100% of a pipe chart? Okay? And in 2000, you did 6%, and then in 2001, you did some more, and that equaled 23% of the pie chart, and then in 2002, it equaled 29% of the pie chart. Is that how I'm supposed to look at that?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. The clarification I'll add is that it is according to the 2000 consent decree. So the pie chart of which you're referring
right.
is a set number of water bodies in the state that we were committed to doing. As I indicated in the response to the question from Representative Shoffler, we are continually monitoring the quality of water and identifying other areas where we're not meeting water quality standards. So that universe under the consent order is not necessarily, is smaller than the entire universe of needed TMDLs in the state.
Okay, so again, if I'm looking at this performance measure correctly, in 2004, your target was 27% of that pie chart. Okay, but in 2003, you were actually ahead of the curve. You were at 34%.
That's correct.
TMDLs. Okay, so and I appreciate this additional information here because that takes us out through 2007. That takes us to 71% is your target in 2007. Do you have a copy of that?
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. So your target is 71%. What I really need to know is I really want to see your, and I should ask you this in the preview, I really want to see to 2010. I want to see what your cumulative targets are clear through 2010.
Could be 100%, Mr. Chair.
Right.
Mr. Chair, the consent order calls out a target in 2008 of 87%. And to have them all completed, those specified, that universe specified by the consent order by 2010. So it would be 100%. And the total number there, the report here does not indicate what that number of segments is, but it's 1,153 segments is the total universe under the consent order.
1,153.
So we have to complete that number of segments by 2010.
That's 87% has to be done by 2008?
That's correct.
Okay, very good. That's I'm glad that you mentioned that to us because that's information we were unaware of. Oh, yes, Senator.
Thank you. If you don't meet the consent order by 2010, is it a guillotine for you or what are the sanctions?
No, we don't have capital punishment in this state in reality, Senator. Sorry.
Senator Nelson, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the consent order also involves the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and so actually they would become responsible for finishing any of the TMDLs that Oregon did not do. If they did not complete those, they would be in contempt of court, which I presume they wish to not be.
Logically, I would assume so also. Okay, and then in performance measure number six, again, the key difference between 5 and 6 is that 5 is a cumulative percentage of segments, okay, which is the 1,153. Measure 6 is the percent of water body miles, which is includes segments, includes everything. It's just water body miles. Why have the two? I mean, what's the rationale to say miles as opposed to segments? Because if the consent order refers to segments, then why even bother with miles?
Mr. Chair, I think it's a really good question. And actually, to be frank, I think we've struggled a little bit with Measure 6 and trying to develop a measure that is more meaningful than just tracking our progress on the consent order. There are additional streams in the state that are we're determining that are impaired, that need TMDLs, and Measure 5 would not tell us anything about them because that's not necessarily part of the consent order. And so we wanted to have a measure that would start to provide us some data and tracking on that.
Okay.
We chose miles, frankly, because we thought it might become a more meaningful way of people to think about it. They might think about stream miles. But we've wrestled a little bit with how to best capture the overall effectiveness of the TMDL program in terms of these kind of performance measures, more outcome-based.
Good explanation, by the way. So it begs another question now, and that is not all of the water bodies that you think may be impaired are under the consent decree. Consent or is it order or consent? It's consent order. Yeah. So there are additional water bodies outside of the consent order that do not meet the federal standards.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. The consent order that was signed in 2000 was based on the list of impaired water bodies that was known at the time. And we, as I indicated, we continue to do monitoring around the state, and we prepare a list of impaired water bodies for EPA every 2 years as required by the Clean Water Act. And so as we do that, our knowledge of water quality conditions and also the universe of TMDLs to do is greater than that 1153 that was specified by the 2000 consent order.
Okay. So what is the total number?
And that's a fabulous question that I don't have off the top of my head, but I can bring that to you.
That'd be great. I mean, part of the thing that I think we're probably going to wrestle with, especially when recommending an approval of policy packages, is how big is the problem? And then after we figure out, you know, we got to define the universe here. How big is the problem? And then how best do we use our resources to fix the problem? And that's what we're going to get to wrestle with. So, yes, Representative Krieger.
I was on the road for a minute. About our shortcoming of that 1,100 and something, how many of those are temperature?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, I can get that. I don't have that information on the top of my head here, but I can give you that information.
Okay, Representative Dingfeld, and then Representative Schaffler.
I just had a question, and this, you probably don't have the answer to this yet, but if we're going to be, because this, some of these are counterintuitive. I mean, I'm like trying to think, and I understand they're also linked to other benchmarks, like looking at, you know, improving water quality in the state, and this is sort of how we're going to get there. But I'm thinking about if we're going to shift. If we do end up doing this more of a watershed permit basis, thinking, shouldn't we also be looking at performance measures for meeting goals within watersheds? Because we're so, I mean, these performance, and I understand, because you, through the consent order, have to look at the 303D list and the certain segments, but thinking down the road, if we are going to look at watershed permits, maybe starting to come up with performance measures that also reflect, you know, trying to have a watershed approach and how many of our watersheds. You know, it's just hard to get, it's really hard to sort of look at these performance measures and think how it is directly linked to our, I mean, the bottom line is we want to have better water quality in the state and, you know, meet this consent order, but TMDL is one way to get there. And just thinking about a couple of these just seems sort of counterintuitive that way.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, I agree with your point, and it's, again, it's one of the things that we've wrestled with is and frankly is something we have some pretty active discussions with EPA about in terms of how do you measure and how do you determine when sort of entire watershed health is recovered. It's certainly an ongoing dialogue that we have internally about trying to come up with the best performance measures. We chose miles for this as trying to be something that might be more understandable to folks that don't intimately live this stuff in the agency. I think your questions indicate we still have a little bit of work to do on that front.
And just one sure. follow-up, because we're going to hear from OWEB next week, right?
That's correct.
And it may be helpful, or maybe we can ask OWEB, because you know I know that OWEB does watershed assessments, and maybe at some point helpful to think about how these performance measures fit in with all the work that OWEB's doing. And they do include water quality, I know, in their assessment process, so may even want to talk to OWEB about that, because we know that you're not doing this in a vacuum, and you're coordinating with OWEB, but there's definitely some overlap, I think, with some of the performance measures that we're looking at for meeting the Oregon plan, for instance.
Representative Dingfelder, Paul might have a good.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, I know that the OWEB has some new measures that you'll be hearing about next week, and I believe some of those are watershed health indicator type measures, and they're still trying to develop others. And I also might mention that during the training from the National Conference of State Legislators, which I believe was last week, one thing they said that Oregon wasn't doing a really good job about reporting was kind of disaggregating data. And so that you might report on a statewide basis, but maybe we can, like this, for your example, you could disaggregate into watersheds and report to four specific watersheds as well. So that's something that I know that we'll be looking at when we review kind of how performance measures are working during the interim.
Well, and the reason I brought that up is just because one of the things I've been really pushing the state to do is take more of a watershed approach. And, for folks like Wayne and I have worked on the Oregon plan for years, that's part of the goal is, you can't just look just at water quality. You have to look at temperature, habitats, all interconnected. And I thought that somebody was working on looking at the integration of the performance measures under the Oregon plan, and maybe OWEB will talk about that next week.
Okay. And Representative Shaw.
Very briefly, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
Every year something changes, somebody comes up with some other idea, or something may or may not be proven correct or accurate. Aren't you really, when you're talking about the number of these segments or miles or sites, the target has to be shifting all the time, because there's always scientific question. If you have an industrial complex that's discharging water right there, that's easy to quantify. You're out in eastern Oregon and some creek, and you're dealing with water temperature. How do how do you get a hard number for what we're dealing with here? Is this just where there is some kind of discharge, or is this out in an agricultural area where it's just meandering through the countryside? So I don't know how you're ever going to really nail these numbers down. I don't see how you're going to do that, quite frankly. It's more of a comment than anything else.
Well, if it's just a comment, then let's move on.
I'm ready.
We got 10 minutes left. I'd like to get through a few more performance measures if we could. Thank you very much for your indulgence.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I'd like Holly to stay here because the next three measures are in water quality.
Outstanding.
Probably help us out. All right, we're on now performance measure number 7, which is on page 18. One of the environmental and efficiency goals of the wastewater program that was supported by our advisory committee that we worked with and is addressed in Senate Bill 45 that will be coming to you as well, is to issue permits, as I mentioned, on a watershed approach. And I talked about that a little bit earlier. This measure is the one that would have us attempting to go to more of a watershed approach for issuing permits. And as you can see, that we set some pretty ambitious goals for being able to do that.
Quite a jump from 2002 to 2003.
Yes, it is, Mr. Chairman. And we basically, to date, have not made much
progress in making the change because of our efforts to reduce the permit backlog. I made a decision that I was going to shift resources from other parts of the water program into permitting so that we could take a chunk out of the backlog, which we did. But toward the future, and Holly can talk more about how this would work, we do expect the entire program to shift to watershed-based permitting and to, in fact, make a lot more progress in achieving the targets that you see here for this measure. And I don't know, Holly, if you want to add anything to that.
No, I think you covered it fairly well. I think we did just basically, this is a strategy measure of our moving to a watershed approach, and we did sort of detour from that a little bit in order to bring down the backlog in a concerted effort. But getting back on this strategy was a key recommendation from the advisory committee, as Director Halleck indicated.
Where's the data for 2003?
Mr. Chair, we essentially, because it wasn't really part of our strategy during 2003 and 2004, it's likely that it's going to be essentially the same data. I can go and try to collect it, but essentially the way that we chose the permits we were going to work on in 2003 and 2004 was not based on geography as it would be under the watershed approach, but it was based on how expired the permits were, because we wanted to get rid of some of those old permits. So we didn't really think that the data would be relevant to the story.
Fair enough. Representative Shockley?
Sure, Mr. Chair. Last summer, I visited, toured the Hinkle Creek study, and the scientist down there said, you know, if you want to apply it to watershed, I guess that's better than state, but he said just from draw to draw, there's difference in temperature in places that had never been touched by anything. Now, how, I'm struggling with this, how are you all going to apply a temperature to a large watershed? How do you come to, and maybe this is not the tough place to ask that question, but that's what they're doing, and that, how are you dealing with that? Are we going to discuss that later, or is this the time to ask that question, or is it in another committee to ask that question?
Mr. Chairman, I
a couple
of things.
Now.
Well, I can address it a bit now. I'd also be happy to have me and Holly come and meet with Representative Shuffler, because I think he's new to some of
yes.
these issues that you are familiar with. And what you, I believe, are referring to is, I mentioned earlier that part of what water quality does and where we start is we set standards. And one of the standards that was set was, in fact, a temperature standard. And I'm sure you've heard a lot about it. So to this question you just asked connects to the earlier question that you asked as well about, do we, in fact, apply standards statewide to all different kinds of streams? And, yes, they do apply. If they're not meeting these water quality standards, whether it's a temperature pollutant or some other kind of pollutant, then they go on a list, and they say, which is, you might have heard of this as well, it's called the 303D list, which refers to the Clean Water Act. And that is a list that we're going to get back to the committee on how many are on there now, because that question was also asked. And that list, what that list says is if this water body or segment or mile or whatever we choose to call it is not meeting water quality standards, then we have to set a total maximum load for it to show what it would take to get it to meet standards. And how you then, so then you get the load, and the load, to answer your earlier question, is a combination of numbers and, if you will, best management practices. Because as you correctly pointed out, not every stream that's on the 303D list or has water quality problems has a bunch of industrial dischargers or sewage treatment plants or whatever. Some are just in farmland or forest land. But if they're not meeting standards, action needs to get taken to bring them into compliance.
Yes, Mr. Chair, it's the structure. How do we get to that? And that may be some, I can talk.
That'll about take you some background time. That is a very complicated and long process to get to. But it is a very good question, and I would encourage you to take the make time for the two of them to sit with you, because I think you need to truly understand that. It will impact your thinking about this problem. And it is a problem, very strongly. Define for me what you mean by percent of individual permits developed. on a watershed basis. What does the word developed mean in this context? Is that, I'm frankly not very clear on that.
Mr. Chair, I think the word developed is probably synonymous with issued, that we've okay. issued on that. Okay. The clarification is that this is a measure of our individual permits, which is usually the larger, more complex facilities, as opposed to those source categories that Director Halleck referred to before that we often permit under what we call a general permit.
And again, these are the issuance of the permits.
Correct.
Not any completed actions based on the issuing of the permit. Okay, I was wondering if developed meant completed actions on the part of the permittee, but that's not what you're referring to. You're just referring to your issuance of basically the permits
on a
watershed basis. Okay, all right, that clears that up. Let's move on to one more, and then we're probably going to call it for good for today.
All right. Well, this is an interesting one to end it on. This is measure number 8, which is on page 20, and I've referred to it several times. This is, in fact, the performance measure that relates to the permit backlog in water quality. And I've talked already about the efforts we've made and are making in the legislation that we propose to bring to you. This measure reports, in fact, on the backlog of all of our permits, our federal water quality permits that we issue on behalf of EPA and our state water pollution control facility permits.
These are all of
these
your
are
permits.
All
this
the water,
is the whole
all water,
universe right
in
here.
Water only. All water permits.
All water permits.
And this measure, we're actually asking, making a formal request for a change in this measure. As you will see on here, it currently reads percent of total permits that are expired. We would like to change that language to percent of total permits that are current. And the reason that we would is we think the way that it's reported now is confusing because it shows an inverted trend line that actually would suggest a decrease in performance when it's actually an increase or an improvement in performance, because our goal is to have 90% of permits current by the end of 2007. So what that would mean is if we changed it, the way it's currently written, 2004 shows a 10% expired. If we change the measure, it would read 90% current. So that's a request we have for that measure.
Okay, makes sense. Members, anything else additionally? That's really it for today. We have seven more to go through.
Maybe 9 through 15.
And we will finish those. Tomorrow, members, we will finish the performance measure.
Monday.
You can come tomorrow.
Ralph, you're welcome to come here tomorrow. That's okay, my friend.
The chair may get through this by himself a lot faster than we are.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought I could. So we're going to do that Monday, and we'll also do the priorities, take a look at those. And again, I would urge you to take just a few minutes and look at the prioritization, both of their programs, within the agency and in their potential cut list, and any questions you might have out of that would be greatly generated.
Senator?
Yes, Senator Shields.
I just wanted to thank Stephanie for a very fine presentation.
She always does well, doesn't she?
Thank you.
Thank you,
Senator. Good to have you with us today.
Was that God?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I might just mention that the department will be presenting some revised sheets on the reduction list just because of the order the reductions are presented in. With some co-chair discussion this morning, they're asking for some standardized approach so that all reductions are prioritized with the cuts you would take first at the top and then moving down the list. So they'll be revising those sheets and bringing them on Monday.
Very good. And with that, thank you all very much, and we are adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.